Welcome everyone to the opening episode of the SEC Marketing Rule Masterclass. We are very excited to have you with us today and to cover such an important part of recent SEC rulemaking that's going to affect so many of our financial market participants. We have two fantastic guests here today, and I also welcome an excellent co-panelist in Carlo DeFlorio. But we'd like to begin today by telling you a little bit about our guest panelists. With the SEC, we have Stephen Levine. Stephen is a senior counsel in the chief counsel's office of the SEC's Division of Investment Management. In this role, Stephen counsels other divisions and offices at the SEC on investment management issues and considers requests for exemptive and action relief. Prior to joining the SEC in 2020, Stephen was an associate at K&L Gates, where he worked in the firm's asset management and investment funds practice group. Chris Mulligan has held a number of positions in the Division of Examinations and Division of Investment Management at the SEC. Chris currently serves as the investment advisor / private funds, senior advisor and co-coordinator of the private funds specialized working group in the Division of Exams. Chris leads the division's efforts to train exam staff and implement new investment advisor rules, including the new SEC marketing rule. Chris has drafted numerous high-profile investment advisor risk alerts, including the only two risk alerts on private fund advisors. Welcome, Stephen. Welcome, Chris. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So as we get started in thinking about the new SEC marketing rule, and we are currently in that very interesting transition period where the rule is technically effective, but we have not yet reached the compliance date. And we thought maybe just to kick things off as Carlo and I get started and really trying to highlight some of the really important parts of these issues, we thought it would be great really to start at the beginning and to focus a little bit on the background on the new SEC marketing rule. But in particular, maybe Stephen, if we could start with you from the IM side, you know, what was some of the motivation, right, to draft the new rule? What was some of the purpose behind that drafting and any other kind of key ideas or elements that you wanted to make sure you built in there in the early stages?
Sure. So before I begin, I will just make clear that the comments that I make today on the podcast are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the commission, the commissioners, or the SEC staff. So with that out of the way, happy to go into some background about the motivation for the rule. I think it's pretty obvious to everyone that in the industry that the existing regulatory regime that we were working with was potentially a bit dated. The advertising rule that was in existence before this most recent rule adoption was adopted in 1961. So we were dealing with an advertising rule from 1961, and there was a cash solicitation rule that was adopted in 1979. Decades have gone by since those rule adoptions, and obviously the ways that investment advisors market their services and use solicitors to, you know, obtain additional clients, you know, those practices have changed dramatically since the initial rule adoptions. One of the consequences of the fact that we are working with rules that are decades old is that a lot of the regulatory regime cropped up in the form of kind of informal staff guidance or other more formal types of staff relief, such as no action letters, which created a circumstance in which many industry participants, in order to parse their ways through the various marketing rule requirements, had to go through piecemeal, you know, different pieces of guidance that were out there contained within a single rule that was easily digestible. So I think at a high level, one of the motivators for this most recent marketing rule was to kind of put everything in one place, you know, eliminate the system that we currently had where there's a bunch of pieces of relief all over the place, and just codify everything at the commission level into a single rule. The hope there is that everyone will be on the same page in the industry as to what the guideposts are for operating in this space. So that's one thing. The second thing is that because the rules were so dated, there was a need to bring them up to date to address, you know, the modern era where we have electronic forms of communication, social media, and, you know, various other things that did not exist at the time that the rule was initially adopted in 1961. So in addition to putting everything into one place, there's an attempt to modernize the rules and make them applicable to the modern era. I think those are the two drivers behind what happened here in the rulemaking process.
Yeah, no, those are, I really appreciate all that background, Stephen. And one of the things that you mentioned that I definitely found apparent, and I think a lot of people in the industry did too, is, you know, there were clear attempts by the staff to really help make this rule evergreen as much as it could, right? To have it be able to stand the test of time versus, you know, the prior advertising rule that, as you mentioned, you know, 60 years ago, right? That's a long time to go by. And certainly the way that a lot of advisor firms conduct business has changed dramatically. But that idea that you know, principle of trying to have this rule be as evergreen as possible was definitely something that you can see written throughout it.
Pat, to that point, I want to, you know, that's an excellent point. And really, that is reflected in the principles-based provisions that are included in the rule. You know, rather than a lot of prescriptive elements contained in the rule, people will notice that there's more of a principles-based approach. And, you know, that really is designed to accommodate the continual evolution and interplay of technology and advice in the investment advisor space. So I think you're exactly right on that point.
So you just, you know, touched on something that I also would love to dig into. And you know, we talk about kind of some of the different principles that are in place. And you know, the SEC listed some principles kind of specifically when it released the rule. Would really love to get your thoughts on those, Stephen, and just maybe, you know, a little bit of background there. And I guess really the question would be, you know, what were some of the things that you were thinking about as you were developing those principles? Were there fundamental elements that the staff knew that it wanted to see in the final construction of those principles? And maybe part of that was also, and I know this, I don't want to get too far ahead, right, in our kind of talk today, but, you know, one of the things that I know we wanted to maybe touch on is also comment letters, right, that had been written, and maybe in the construction of those principles, maybe we grab elements or parts of comment letters and try to codify them into federal statute. But anyway, let's start maybe at a bit higher level rather than go granular right away. And just in general, were there, you know, specific elements that you wanted to make sure you built into those fundamental principles that were part of the rule?
Yeah. So, and at the outset, I just want to say that my role in this process on a personal level is more on the interpretive side. Being in chief counsel's office, my colleagues in rulemaking, who I worked very closely with throughout this process, you know, really were more involved in the construction of the rule. But I can say pretty confidently that the overarching principle is something that should not surprise anyone. And it's just the general sense that the commission believes that advertisement presents risks to misleading investors. There is an obvious idea that's out there that an advisor's interest in, you know, attracting investors may conflict with the investor's best interests. So I think that everything that contained in the rule flows from that general principle, which is that advisors in their attempts to attract investors through the use of advertisements could potentially mislead investors. The general prohibitions that are set forth in the rule really are all designed to prevent the misleading of investors. And then there are more prescriptive elements that flow from the general prohibitions that apply to things like performance advertising and testimonials and endorsements. But I think it all ties back to that overarching principle. You know, in my mind, it's fairly simple. It's a fairly simple starting point. We're concerned that people might buy investment advice on bad information. How do we prevent that?
Yeah, that's really helpful. And again, I think, you know, it was those kinds of considerations that I know, at least, you know, at a professional level, I was so glad that the SEC built into that, because I think in general, like most firms should have already, you know, been operating from that standpoint, right? That like the anti-fraud provisions of the Advisors Act and other elements of that where you know, you don't want to do anything that ultimately, because of an act or an omission, misleads investors in any way, and marketing and advertising can kind of get swept up into that. And this is an extension of that, right? And you talked about how there are going to be, you know, prescriptive elements that get built on. Certainly performance marketing is one of those key areas that a lot of firms, you know, take, it can interpret in a variety of different ways, and that can be challenging. But no, I definitely appreciate that. So glad to hear that the staff kind of was using that as its baseline. Let's maybe shift it slightly, because we've talked about some of those core principles that I think is so important, and look at some of the nuances to the new rule. You know, I know there have been a couple, you know, FAQs that the staff has pushed out at this point. Maybe, you know, provide a little bit of background on those FAQs and maybe why those were published. And then maybe we can start to think about, you know, some of the other kind of key nuances or analysis of some of the other items involved with the rule.
Yeah, sure. So basically, there are currently two FAQs out on the rule. And, you know, people in the industry might be saying, gee, that doesn't seem like many for a rule of this scope. You know, the adopting release is pretty long. And we have received a number of inquiries from industry participants about various elements of the rule. But the reason that there's two right now is basically that, you know, we do believe that the rule, along with the adopting release, is very comprehensive and is specifically designed, as I said in my opening remarks, to really put everything in one place so that everyone is on the same page. So our thinking at this point is that the need for FAQs, which are things that really sit outside of the rule itself, is fairly limited. And there's a fairly high threshold for us, you know, getting to the point where we're going to think that the rule needs to be supplemented with informal staff guidance in the form of FAQs. And that's just for the obvious reason that that one of the motivating factors for this rule in the first place was to get away from the practice of people referring outside of the rule to see what practices are permissible and what practices are not permissible. So there really is an attempt to you know, keep things within the rule at this point, which is why there are only two FAQs. The two that are out there are really what I would consider more technical in nature. One of them is potentially important for people that are listening to this right now, assuming they're listening to it before the November compliance date. And that FAQ basically says that an advisor may, but is not required to comply with the new marketing rule in advance of the compliance date. However, if an advisor chooses to comply with any part of the new marketing rule, it must shift its, you know, compliance program over to it. Basically, it must comply with all of the rule, not only part of it. So an advisor can't say, I'm going to start complying with the performance advertising provisions of the new marketing rule, you know, in advance of the compliance date. But as to other aspects of the rule, I'm going to stick with the old regime. Basically, you're either in the old regime or you're in the new regime, but you can't be straddling both. So I think it's important for people to know that if you've chosen to kind of move your advertising pieces into, you know, starting to comply with the new rule, that would be a signal that you should probably be adopting compliance procedures that cover the entire rule, because we don't see if the SEC staff comes in and sees that there's some piece of the new rule that's being complied with, then that will be a signal that the advisor has kind of shifted to the new marketing regime and no longer will be able to rely on the prior rule and the prior SEC staff no action letters that were issued under that prior rule to demonstrate that it's being to demonstrate that its advertisements are compliant with the federal securities laws. So that's one piece. That's what one FAQ does. The other FAQ is really just a technical, you know, we thought that there needed to be a technical clarification because the performance advertisement piece requires that any advertisement containing performance information must have, you know, the performance displayed as of certain time periods that end on a date that is no more recent than the most recent calendar year end. And we had some people come in and say, well, you know, what if we're putting out an advertisement that includes performance and that performance, you know, that advertisement is issued in, say, January of a given year, so January 6th, you know, we might not have performance data as of the prior year end, December 31st, because the advertisement is issued just a few days after the calendar year end. And in that instance, we at the SEC staff issued an FAQ and said, okay, if you have an advertisement that's issued very shortly after the calendar year end, we'll allow you to use interim performance information that is current as of the most recent calendar quarter, which would be the third quarter of the prior year. And we generally believe that you should be able to update that in performance information as of the most recent calendar year end within a month of the calendar year end. So that's what the other FAQ does, really just a very technical thing to help firms understand what their obligations are to the extent that they put out performance advertisements very early on in the calendar year.
Yeah, no, thank you for all of that additional context. That's really, really helpful. And, you know, I want to go back to one of the items that you mentioned at the top of kind of in thinking about the description of the FAQs that I think is also really important. And I definitely think that, you know, many of the legal and compliance nerds listening to this podcast would be very interested in hearing, which is that, you know, another one of the main drivers with the new marketing rule is kind of the idea that we could try to have one-stop shopping when it came to marketing and advertising and the rules underneath there, so that you wouldn't have to go to, you know, a volume of different resources in order to try to find the right answer on a particular question that you had on whether something was going to be, you know, okay to publish or distribute among different investors and what that's going to look like and the types of things and considerations you need to have involved, but rather a consolidation, you know, of a lot of different guidance into one rule in a way that ultimately, while, you know, there's going to be some adjustment from firms right now on the front end, ultimately, I think it would be the goal that it's going to streamline firms' abilities to build the proper internal controls around the marketing and advertising that they have in place and what that's going to look like long term. So,
yeah, that's exactly right. It should be a much, I don't know if simpler is the process itself. The process itself may not be simpler, but right. In terms of understanding, I think that it should be easier to grasp what the actual requirements are, because they really are just set forth in the rule and there is not all of these other extraneous materials to consult. So yeah. I think that's fair to say. But to that point, because everything has been rolled into the rule itself, people also should keep in mind that, you know, prior SEC staff no action letters that they may have been relying on to inform their existing practices, you know, those staff no action letters have been withdrawn and rescinded. So it no longer will be, you know, viable in order to demonstrate to the SEC staff that a particular advertisement complies with the rule, you know, pointing to a no action letter no longer is an acceptable way to do that. There has to be something within the rule itself or the adopting release that justifies the underlying content that is being questioned. So I think that, you know, there's two sides to this coin. A, it's simpler to the extent that everything's in one place, but also to the extent that people have gotten used to pointing to various different resources, those resources are no longer authoritative for the purpose of complying with the rule.
That's a really great comment and very helpful. And I know many of the listeners to the podcast will appreciate that because, again, I think if nothing else, it's instructive for them, right? That hey, you know, you may have been able to rely on the elements of prior no action letters when you were developing your own compliance manual, policies and procedures and other internal controls that said essentially, for this piece of marketing that I'm getting ready to push out, I'm allowed to do this. And I'm allowed to do it this way because I can point to this other no action letter. We'll get into later how then the division of examinations with Chris is then going to interpret what you've done, you know, now, but that's, I think that's a really helpful point, Stephen. One of the other items that I would love to dig into is specifically on the new rule. And then maybe we'll kind of start to kind of transition over to some of more of the examination stuff is, from a feedback from the industry standpoint, you know, the rule's now been out for a while, right? I mean, over a year and a half since published, more than a year since it was made effective. You know, what kind of feedback have you seen from the industry? You know, I'm curious to get some of your thoughts there. I'm sure when we get into, talking with Chris about some of what he's seeing on the examination side, we can dig into that too. But I guess more specifically, you know, the feedback that IEM has received from industry participants and you know, and maybe analysis of some of the more maybe controversial parts or just kind of some, what you're seeing out in the space.
Sure. So I think that industry participants largely have welcomed this rule, and that's at least what I hear. You know, I'm sitting in the regulator's chair, so maybe behind my back something else is, you know, there's a different characterization. But at least what's expressed to me as I engage with participants of the industry, there seems to have been a universal understanding that the prior framework was outdated and untenable. Or I wouldn't say untenable, but you know, it was getting to the point where there needed to be some updates. I think people welcomed the clarifications that are included in the new rule. I think people welcomed the simplicity of having everything codified in one place, as opposed to relying on various pieces of staff guidance that emerged over the decades. What I did see is a lot of technical questions, because obviously, as the no action letters were withdrawn, the bases or sources of authority that people were used to people were comfortable with no longer were there. So as people looked to the new rule, I think they appreciated the goal of the new rule and largely appreciated the content of the new rule. But a lot of questions arose as to technical aspects of, you know, my firm is doing X, Y, and Z. How would the staff evaluate that in light of the requirements of the new rule? And from that perspective, you know, we at the staff are basically in a position of saying, you know, we're not really able to apply the facts and circumstances of a particular business model or a particular advertising piece to the principles that are expressed in the new rule. That's really the job of each firm to work through on their own. So I think that people like the idea of the new rule. I think people might be a little apprehensive about how their existing practices fit into the new rule and how they might need to adapt. But that's the work, you know, that's why there was a fairly lengthy compliance period for people to, you know, get used to the actual content of the new rule and go through the exercise of making changes where necessary. So yeah, I haven't heard much controversy brought to my attention, really just more questions that unfortunately I'm usually unable to weigh in on, which are, hey, this is what we plan to do. Would you guys rubber stamp this or would you have a problem with it? And that's really not the type of thing that we're able to engage.
Great, Stephen, thanks. That's Carlo. Just a couple of questions. You describe the overarching principles and what illuminates the rule and the objectives of it, which is great and really, really helpful. Another really interesting part that not all of our listeners might appreciate is just how the rulemaking process works and how comments are meant to inform the rulemaking process and be taken into consideration when you think about costs and impacts and benefits and unintended consequences. Can you share whether there were any interesting input that came in through the comment letter process that helped to inform the rule or adjust the rule in any way in its final form?
Yeah, sure. I mean, first of all, there was a number of comments that came in. There were more than 90 comment letters that were submitted on the proposal. So, you know, there definitely was significant interest in the industry in this particular piece of rulemaking. I think that, you know, let's go to the fundamental aspect of the rule, which is advertisement. I mean, even the definition of advertisement, I think up until the very end, you know, was the subject of a great deal of scrutiny. You know, whether you'll see in the definition, for example, that advertisements generally are written communications that are distributed to more than one person. However, there's a carve out for hypothetical performance where if hypothetical performance is presented, then an advertisement fits within the definition distributed to even just one person. So I think that you can see in kind of the nuance in just the definition of advertisement under the rule, kind of the great deal of scrutiny that or interest people had in outlining exactly what types of communications would be covered by the rule. So even at that threshold level, what's an advertisement and what's not an advertisement, there's evidence in the rule, and there's, you'll see in the public comment file, you know, a great deal of interest of what falls within that. People did also request, you know, various guidance. How do I put this? There was competing requests for a more principles-based approach on the one hand versus certainty as to what content would be acceptable or not by inserting some more prescriptive elements in the rule. So I think what you end up with is something that kind of really is more a principles-based rule, but does have at its core, you know, certain prescriptive pieces of information in it, such as, you know, required time periods for performance presentations and things of that nature. So I think that there was a little push and pull there. And on the one hand, people are, you know, should be satisfied that they have room to work with various pieces of, you know, various types of content that they want to put out there because there is this principles-based framework. But then when it comes to the presentation of more, you know, types of information that the staff might or the commission might have more concern about its potential to mislead investors, such as performance, that there are actual concrete content requirements in there. And that, you know, kind of all was ferreted out through the comment process.
That's great. That's really helpful, Stephen. Maybe as we transition to Chris, just one last question for you is, can you share with folks how the policy process accounts for potentially revisiting the rule after a year of examinations and feedback through that? Is there a mechanism in the rulemaking process to revisit, whether through FAQs or other forms of guidance?
So this is what I would say. Sitting in Chief Counsel's office, we are always happy to hear from the industry if there are questions or, you know, if someone thinks that there's an unintended consequence, for example, and they think that something really needs to be addressed. You know, our line is always open. Our email address is constantly monitored. So if people want to get in touch with us, you know, look up Chief Counsel's office on the SEC webpage. And, you know, we're happy to interact with the public. I don't know how much, you know, obviously the rulemaking process is its own formal kind of procedure. Having just been adopted, I don't know. I can't really speak to the appetite that, the commission would have to revisiting the rule itself through that type of formal process. But to the extent that there is interpretive questions that arise or a need for some type of relief, certainly within Chief Counsel's office, that's something that falls within our purview. I cannot anticipate right now the extent to which we would take up that, you know, take up a request for any type of relief that might come up in the future. But my what I would say is if people have questions or if people have requests of us, they should reach out to us and we can work through it with them on a case-by-case basis.
Great. Very helpful, Stephen. Thanks. Chris, maybe with that, we'll turn over to you on the exams front. Stephen and Patrick had a really good discussion around how the, you know, adopting release and the text of the rule is what governs going forward, and 60 years of no action letters and the like have been retired. How has the exam program prepared for the effort to undertake exams in this area, both with regard to sort of early adoption and then with what we've got coming forward here on November 4th?
Thanks for the question, Carlo. And similar to Stephen, let me just reiterate that the views I express today are my own and don't necessarily reflect the views of the commission, the commissioners, or the other staff at the SEC. So the advertising rule is a core provision. The old advertising rule has been and is a core provision of our exams, right? So you think about, you know, the issues that we very frequently look at on examinations: fiduciary duty, conflicts of interest, custody rule, code of ethics, compliance rule. You know, advertising is right up there, right? This is a core rule that we look at. And until the new rule was adopted and continuing, frankly, I'll talk about that in a second, continuing until today, it's really been one provision under the old advertising rule where most of the action was, right? So there was this kind of general misleading prohibition in the old advertising rule. And then under that, as Stephen was saying, was decades of no action letters, of guidance. And so we were, the behavior was quite, could be somewhat complicated to examine for and understand and compare to the legal requirements, but like the technical citation was often the same. It was one provision under the old advertising rule. And so, you know, this is obviously a very big change for us. And I think exams is it's not fair to say we're like in the same position as registrants, but I mean, we are trying to learn this new rule, and it is technically just so different than what we have been utilizing for the past, you know, since the exams began in the 90s. So the other kind of unique thing about it is, and you applied this, Carlo, is that there are really two starting points for this. So because there has been this optionality for the past year and continuing until November for advisors to choose either the old advertising rule with everything that came with it, with all the no action letters, with all the guidance, or adopt the new rule, we've sort of been in a posture where we have to be able to analyze under both rules, which is somewhat challenging for us. So we had a huge gear up when last March, when advisors could begin to use, or last April, when advisors could begin to use the new rule, because we're like, we have to be able to analyze it under the new rule if it comes to it. And we really didn't know what to expect in terms of how many advisors would go to the new rule. So yeah, we rolled out the trainings and we rolled out the release and model deficiencies, and you know, we really got geared up for this. Like, here's how we're going to do this. And the reality is very, very few advisors have moved to the new rule early. That may begin to change this summer as advisors begin to face the reality that this is coming one way or the other, and maybe let's jump a little early. But I think it's fair to say that, like, you know, that has not happened. And so, you know, we got sort of out of practice, right? We were gearing up for this, and then sort of we went right back to the old advertising rule, and we're still citing the same things that we've cited before, and now we're gearing up again. And so later this summer and this fall, we are going to go through the same process, and anything we've learned since then, we are going to, you know, train staff and examiners and have a working group and, you know, everything that comes with implementing such a new rule. And I think, so, you know, that start and stop has made things a little bit difficult, but you know, this will be it, right? So in November, we'll only have the new rule, so we can kind of let all that old stuff retire. I think, you know, just any tips I could give is start with your policies and procedures. Start with your policies and procedures. That's what we're going to look at first, right? Like, you have to at least acknowledge, like, we're going to want to know that you have acknowledged the world has changed and that there's a new rule, right? And that's kind of expressed through your policies and procedures. So I think that's sort of the baseline that we're going to look at. And is something that advisors should spend a lot of time on. And I think that will, you know, if you start right, if you build the kind of foundation correctly, hopefully that will flow through everything else. If you have a process in place for understanding the new rule, implement those policies correctly, or at least implement them at first, right? Let's start with implementing them. Hopefully they will be implemented correctly as you kind of build up and the final product, the final advertisements that are utilized will be in compliance with the new rule. So that, you know, that's where I would start. I think, you know, there's obviously for us, from our perspective, because we draft efficiency letters, there's tremendous technical issues here, right? You have to draft, like, and before it was like, okay, there's one provision of the rule and then there's, you know, some guidance and no action letters and things under it. But like, technically that's what we're citing a violation for. We don't cite violations and no action letters, we cite violations of rules. And it was kind of always the same rule. Now, you know, this is a very long rule with a lot of provisions. And so we want to make sure that we're interpreting it, you know, we're looking at this correctly and we're citing the right sections. And that's just sort of a technical challenge on exam side that we're engaged in. And substantively, I think a lot of the substance is similar, like don't mislead people. But, you know, there are differences. Like the cash solicitation rule is gone, for example, and it's being replaced with restrictions on endorsements and testimonials. The testimonials, by the way, were prohibited under the old rule, right? So now they're allowed, but they've sort of replaced kind of the cash solicitation requirement. So that is a substantive difference, right? And there's new requirements. One of the requirements about, you know, material claims of material fact have to be substantiated or can be substantiated. And that's something that is near and dear to exams heart, right? We love documents, right? We love substantiation. We love things we can look at. And so that's a provision I imagine we will focus on quite a bit. You know, there's new track, you know, much clearer track record requirements, right? Before it was sort of like, can't be misleading, but what exactly does that, you know, sometimes it can be difficult to understand how that played out with certain types of hypothetical and back tested. Now we have like very clear requirements, which I think is great, but it is much more technical and substantively, I think somewhat different as well. So we're going to be looking at that as well. And, we're going to be using this new rule. We're going to be looking at this, and then registrants, you know, very likely are going to have some difficulty with it as well, and maybe not understand it fully. So yeah, I think next year is going to be very, very interesting on the exams front with the marketing rule, because you're going to have exams ramping up, learning this, and you're going to be dealing with registrants that are also learning it and ramping up. So, you know, we will see how next year goes, but it's going to be very exciting. It's going to be very interesting. I think a tremendous benefit from this new framework that Stephen described is that, you know, people will pull out no action letters from the 80s and the 70s and talk about stuff that hadn't, you know, it was very difficult to kind of apply some of those principles to like what was happening today with technology and everything else. And now it's a state of the art rule all in one place. So, you know, we're going to be looking in the same place. Registrants going to be looking in the same place. I am going to be looking in the same place. So we all know what the playbook is here. And so I think in the long run, it's certainly going to be very helpful. You know, in the short term, you know, I think there will be some growing pains, but it's going to be worth it. But it's going to be, you know, a challenging time.
That's great. Thanks, Chris. You know, I do think that, as Patrick alluded to, one of the principles you and Stephen have articulated that I think is really helpful for listeners is we're moving forward, right? Anchoring the adopting release and the rule. And as Patrick and I work with clients to help them understand how to move towards compliance with this, it's hard for people to let go of their compliance programs. They spend so much time building to anchor in, no action rule relief and the like. But knowing that you all are going to come in as exams and that your exam protocols are based on the adopting release and the text of the rule, and you're going to get into technical issues, not just sort of good faith compliance in the first year, really helps people focus the mind on doing the gap analysis, identifying the policy and procedure that they need to create or update or align with the rule, and then roll that out. I think that's a really helpful piece of guidance from both of you. You mentioned, Chris, substantiation of material fact, right? That's kind of the heart and soul of the exam division. There's a lot of firms that are really focused on that right now. And what exactly is that going to mean in oral, testimonials and the like, particular circumstances where books and records don't seem as typical and easy to have? How have you and the team talked and thought through how you're going to approach substantiation of material fact? What are you looking for?
Yeah. Well, I think this is where I think advisors can really get ahead of the game if they have policies and procedures for how they interpret it, right? So, there's language in the release about creating contemporaneous records or knowing how to get them if you need to substantiate it. So you don't have to keep the record, you know, in your drawer, but having a process to make sure you can substantiate statements of material fact. So, you know, there's some guidance in the release, and we'll certainly use that. But I think this and in a number of other places, it's really going to be advantageous for the advisor, and it's going to help your exam go much better if you can articulate what you're thinking, right? Like this is all new, you know, and so you know, if we come in and say, how can you substantiate this statement of material fact? You say, why would I have to do that? Right. That's not going to give our examiners like a lot of confidence that you understand the rule and are grappling with it and trying to comply with it. If, on the other hand, you can articulate, here's how we identified material facts that we used in advertisements, and then here's how the process we have for substantiating them, and here's how our process for record keeping. And, you know, and we may disagree with that. I'm not saying that's going to be a silver bullet, but that is really going to help. And a lot of these, if you can, you know, I think if you can articulate what you're thinking, you know, this is going to be new to a lot of examiners, most, you know, at the beginning, all examiners, basically, and to the lawyers helping them. So, you know, I think you could really get ahead of the game if you are able to utilize what's there and just make it, you know, make it try, you know, try to comply with the new rule and articulate how you're attempting to do that. That is going to be tremendously helpful. You know, I think the less it seems like you have any idea the new rule is even out there, you know, the more shaky ground you're going to be on when you're talking to examiners. And then we might sort of impose our own thoughts on what on what you should do. So I think, again, building that foundation of policies, and this is across all rules, of course, but I mean, I think for this one, because it's brand new, it's getting critical. Build that foundation of policies and procedures, have a process that you can articulate, that you can tell us about, and then, you know, and we'll see what happens, but that's going to be a really great place to start, I think, for registrants.
Really helpful, Chris. Let me ask one more question, then turn it back to Patrick. One of the things, and you personally have been involved in this, that's been extremely helpful from the Division of Exams is risk alerts, right? It's where you come back to the industry and say, you know, we spent a year or 18 months doing exams in a particular area. Here's what we've observed in terms of typical deficiencies, and here's what we've observed as effective practices. And then everybody takes that and really helps get the house further in order. How are you thinking about a risk alert here, kind of time frame, nature of it? What are your thoughts generally? Because you're involved in writing them.
Yeah. So we really put a lot of thought and effort into our risk alerts, and we try to really make sure that they are aimed squarely at CCOs, right? This is one of, like, one of the few documents I think we issue at the commission that is like, we really try to write clearly, not a lot of legalese. Like, you're a CCO, what should I do? Here's what you should do. Here's the problems to try to fix. I mean, that's what we really try to do with these risk alerts. And look, we have to have deficiencies first, you know, because we're not IM, right? We can't write no action. We can't write guidance. We're in the deficiency business. We cite deficiencies. We can describe deficiencies that we've cited. So we don't have any deficiencies yet, or not very, very few. So I'm not trying to be cute about this. I mean, look, I think it would shock me if a risk alert on the new marketing rule is not something that we begin to think about as soon as we have the kind of body of deficiencies that we need to draft a risk alert. But I can't, you know, I don't have a timeline, and it's certainly not something we can work on, because we first need to, you know, see what's happening. But obviously that's going to be something that, you know, and we try to put ourselves in the heads of CCOs when we're drafting these or we're picking topics. And, you know, I can't imagine a topic that would be more important to a CCO than the brand new marketing rule. But I think we want to be careful and not rush it, because we don't, you know, maybe the very early exams we're doing on this, you know, lead us in one direction. But if we had another month or 2 or 3 months of exams, if we get a clear picture of where the problems are. So I think it's a good, you know, I think that's something we're going to think very strongly about, but I think we also have to be careful and not rush and maybe present something as a problem that really isn't. It just happened to show up on some early exams. So, you know, we'll see, but obviously that's something that I'm sure CCOs would love to see. And that's basically what informs our risk alert process.
Great insights, Chris. Thanks. Patrick, back to you.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks, Carlo. And thanks, Chris. That was really, really, really helpful feedback. You mentioned a couple things in there and a couple items I'd love just a quick follow up on. One was, you know, look, I really appreciate your comment where you say, you know, the firms should look to try to comply with the new rule and take some effort there. I think, you know, it's where you get into those examinations and you have advisors and it's clear that they didn't even try. They didn't even try to put in the work. They didn't adjust internal controls or policies and procedures to try to accommodate these new this new principles-based regime under the new SEC marketing rule, where, you know, you're certainly going to run into some problems. And I guess one of the things, you know, Carla mentioned that the notion around, you know, future risk alerts. And again, I really appreciate your thoughts there too, Chris. I would also encourage, you know, advisors in the interim, before some of those risk alerts come out. I know it can seem a bit heavy, but the adopting release has some really good information in it too. It really does. And if you go in, if you pour into some of the details of the adopting release that again, highlight some of the comments that were received from the SEC, how those were looked at, how they were approached, and then why they came out where they did in certain areas, I have also found that effective. You know, I think, look, there's still things that are going to get flushed out over time, and no one's going to have a silver bullet for any particular kind of thing here. There's no panacea, but I think the adopting release would have some really good content, and I would encourage lots of participants to take a look at that.
Absolutely. And, you know, when Stephen and you were talking earlier about, you know, if an advisor is relying on a no action letter, you know, they have to be careful because they can't rely on that anymore. But, you know, a lot of the older no action letters were sort of imposed obligations, right? I mean, they said, you know, not imposed, but they interpreted that misleading clause in such a way that it kind of pushed the industry to do certain things. And I think going forward, you know, you can't pull out a no action letter, but you also don't have to worry about exams pulling out a no action letter from like 1979 and saying, well, under this, you know, this is deemed misleading. Like, it's all there. It's yeah. In one document, and it is long and it is complicated, but it is all there. And I think that it's going to be refreshing in some ways, because we're not, you know, exams and registrants aren't going to be trading old no action letters or guidance back and forth and said, you know, it's either in the release or it's not, or in the rule text. And, you know, I think it'll be refreshing in some ways.
I think that's spot on. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that. And you're right. I mean, that is going to be, again, a real benefit for firms who, in the past, when it came to marketing and advertising, I mean, and I'm using the other thing I wanted to mention, which is an anecdote of an advisor that is a perfect, maybe a tie the bow on that comment, and also kind of leads into the final part of the conversation I love to get to, which is that this advisor had a binder, a thick, think of like a municipal code level size binder, just full of no action letters that had been organized and that talked about these different things. And they were so sad when they realized that they weren't going to be able to use this. And it was, look, I'll be honest, it was something to behold. I mean, it really was. It was a thing of beauty. At the same time, that, I mean, think about the level of effort that took to put that together and to pull all the different resources involved in all the organization here. Like you said, right, you're going to have, it's one-stop shopping. I mean, again, it's not necessarily, there are parts of it that are going to be more complicated than others. There are times that it can be a little dense and whatever else, but it is all there. And firms can certainly use the information in the rule, in the adopting release, to help really inform how they want to build their compliance program. Getting to kind of the application part of the new rule, this is really kind of where we're going to open it up for both of you. Would love to hear your thoughts. And Carlo, certainly feel free to jump in too with any additional thoughts or questions here. You know, when it comes to the application of the new rule, you know, would there be certain things that you would expect from firms as far as kind of managing and refining their policies and procedures? I know you said, and so we're working off of very limited information right now, Chris, you know, to your point, there just hasn't been that kind of groundswell of adoption yet. But I guess maybe if you could share any tips or tricks of what you might encourage firms to do when it comes to managing and refining their policies and procedures, and just any other thoughts on that process. And Stephen, feel free to jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I'm sure Chris has his own thoughts on this, but one thing that I would encourage, and something that I've kind of experienced through engaging with members of the industry, is you know, I can't tell people what the best approach is because I don't know. I once upon a time I was in-house, and I know that there's a lot that goes into developing compliance policies and procedures, but because there is kind of this old framework that's being replaced with something more modernized and new, I would encourage people to kind of read the new rule as a standalone, you know, piece of, as a standalone regulation and really digest it on its, as a standalone thing, because right now if it might be very complicated for people to try to piece together, well, this is, you know, what the old, you know, regulatory regime was. Let me like see how it ties into the new regulatory regime. You know, people might be drawing arrows all over the place to see what lines up with what. And maybe that's a useful exercise. Maybe it's not. It's probably part of the puzzle, but I would say that it's not the whole puzzle, because if people are not reading the rule on its own and really taking time to absorb it, then I think that they might miss the forest for the trees, basically. So, and that's just something that I've learned in conversations where people are asking questions, you know, really spinning their wheels, trying to line something up under an old no action letter from the 70s, for example, and trying to see how it fits into the new rule. You know, if they had just read the rule itself on its own, and, you know, the answer is there, basically. The answer is there. So I can't tell anyone how to you know, engage in this practice, because everyone's going to have their own way of going about it. But at least part of the equation should be appreciating this for a standalone rule, as a standalone rule, rather than trying to draw arrows to the existing regime.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we sort of went through that process in exams, because we had to figure out how we're going to cite this. And, you know, and other changes in rules, when there's tweaks or new guidance or new FAQs, we're going to take what we have, tweak our internal guidance, tweak our model language, and sort of, you know, move on. You know, as we began this process for updating our model language and our guidance, it became evident that this, it was not remotely possible to sort of kind of just tweak what we had and sort of limp along. Like, we just had to kind of throw that out of the trash can and start over. And now as you do that, though, you do realize that a lot of the activities are problematic under both regimes. And so I think structurally starting over is really the right answer. I mean, I think you have to deal with the new rule on its own and not try to kind of connect it to old things. But I think once you actually get to the activity, once you've gone through that process and you actually look at the activity, you look at the type of marketing, I think what you're going to see, again, we're new at this too, but I think what you're going to see is that a lot of the activity is prohibited under both. Just how you cite it, how you kind of look at it, and under what rule is very, very different. But in the end, you know, the actual activity is going to be pretty similar. So, I mean, you know, I think structurally and technically you sort of have to start over, but like whether or not, once you go through that process, you can look and see, well, you know, some of this, you know, there's a lot of crossover at the end of the day, but you got to build from the ground up under the new rule.
Good insights, guys. Another thing is people begin to prepare, you know, and continue to prepare for compliance with the rule is, are there tools that can help in a compliance? And one that I think a lot of people have been getting to know a lot better is layered disclosure, right? And how layered disclosure might help to meet the principles of the disclosure requirements in this new rule. Any perspectives you all can share on tools, layered disclosure, others that you think are thoughtful ways of meeting the spirit of the rule?
I can say this. I think that, you know, I'm not going to talk about any specific rule requirements and how people, you know, specific types of disclosures that might address those rule requirements. But I can say this, that for me, working through the rule, something that's been very helpful is just kind of going back to the general prohibitions sometimes, because there are very technical provisions. I keep going back to performance because that's one of the biggest ones, but also testimonials and endorsements, you know, very, very technical provisions that apply to certain types of advertising. And you can kind of get caught in the weeds there if you don't take a step back and go back to the general prohibitions and say, what are we trying to do in the first place here? The question is always going to be, and I open with this, is, you know, is there a potential here to mislead investors? So I think when in doubt, you know, if you're operating in some sort of gray area and you're trying to see if you can tick some technical box under the rule, and you're not sure whether or not you can tick that box or not, and you're kind of on the fence, take a breath, go to the general prohibitions, understand the general intent of the rule in the first place, which is to prevent misleading investors or potential investors, and say, you know, does the content that I'm putting out, you know, does it further the intent of the rule by being more protective of, you know, the investors in terms of preventing misleading information, or would it tend to potentially be misleading and therefore undermine the intent of the rule? And I think that if you take that kind of broader approach to understanding what we're doing here, then some of the technical requirements may resolve themselves more easily.
Good insight. Chris, anything on your end?
No, I think it's going to be, again, helpful if you're thoughtful about it. If you can walk us through, this is why we used layered disclosure. This is why we think it's consistent with the principles. The links work, you know, that sort of stuff, rather than, oh, is that a problem? I think there might be a link in that lead somewhere that might save the day. Like that sort of stuff is not as helpful as you being proactive and explaining, hey, we think this is a good idea. We think this is helpful. And we think this complies with the principles. That's going to help you tremendously on exam if you're able to articulate that and demonstrate it.
Great. That's great. Yeah, that's great. I think maybe we can start to wrap up. I guess one final note, just would be really interested to hear both your thoughts on, you know, any closing thoughts for firms, right? Either from, you know, more of the policy and procedure building side, maybe in what they're doing on that front with regard to their compliance manuals and other internal controls, or maybe it's training, right? Maybe, you know, Chris, in the examination side, you know, one key thing I know that examiners also love to see is where the firm's done training with their investment professionals and talk to them about, hey, there's this new rule in place. Okay. And here are the elements of it that are going to apply to your advisory activities and the stuff that you're doing. And so now when you're going on LinkedIn and you're, you know, doing certain things, you know, you need to keep this in mind, because as it relates to testimonials and endorsements or other stuff like that, just being really cognizant of that. So I guess maybe we'll kind of open it up for you both, but would welcome any additional kind of closing thoughts or other things that you think would be really important for firms to consider as they look to come into compliance with the rule.
Absolutely about training. I mean, you know, part of your policy procedure especially for a new rule has to be training. And our examiners will have been through so much training on this that they're going to want to see that the advisor had to suffer through it as well, same as them. So no, that's a very important point. And the idea that you could, you know, update your policy procedures, not tell anyone about it, you know, send it around, and somehow that would work, is not going to fly. So absolutely, I'm glad you mentioned that. Training the staff, particularly the people that use advertising materials, that develop it. I mean, they have got to be trained in this new rule 100%. And it's going to take a while. I mean, it's going to be probably a little bumpy at first, but that has to be a core part of your policy procedures on this.
Yeah, I from my perspective, I think that people, you know, I would hope that people view this as an opportunity, really, to provide some more certainty into the more modernized marketing activities that they engage in, you know. So I think, yes, I would lead with that. Hopefully this isn't viewed as a hindrance, but it's viewed as an opportunity. And I think if used correctly, it is an opportunity. And beyond that, you know, just make sure that, you know, the provisions of the rule are there. They're designed to protect investors and potential investors. And if something seems off, you know, I'll give one example. You know, the rule has certain prescribed time periods for presenting performance, for example. But the rule also says that a written communication to more than one person is an advertisement. So presumably, I know I've received questions where people are saying, well, if we provide a written communication to just one person, then it's not an advertisement and we don't need to comply with certain provisions of the rule, such as the performance presentation requirements. And, you know, my response to that is, you know, the answer is maybe, You know, if you don't have an advertisement, then you're not required to comply with the rule. That's for certain. Although you would be subject to other, you know, general anti-fraud aspects of the Advisors Act, but I'll leave that alone. But, you know, people really need to dig in and understand, and this is where the adopting release and the clarifications that are in the adopting release, I think, are super helpful. You know, the adopting release specifically says, well, although one-on-one communications generally are not advertisements, you know, if you have, if you duplicate the same piece of information and provide it to more than one person, that duplicated information, we will treat as an advertisement and it will be subject to the requirements of the advertising rule. So I guess my message is, you know, people shouldn't try to get too cute with this stuff. It just because it's a written communication to more than one person doesn't mean that duplicated information that is sent on a one-on-one basis to multiple people is, you know, somehow excluded from the rule. I think this is all kind of common sense stuff, but it goes along with the general sense of read the rule, read the release, because if you understand the general principles there, then you won't get caught in you won't get caught in a scenario where you think you're doing something that is, you know, permitted by the words on the page, but in reality, it is kind of undermining the intent of the rule, and the adopting release tells you that you shouldn't have been doing that in the first place. So I think there's a lot of resources out there, both in the rule text itself and the adopting release. I hope people will use those resources, because they're the same resources that we at the staff are looking to when we when we put out our own interpretations and, you know, as to what the rule means.
Yeah, really great points from both of you on that front. And just to echo what you were just mentioning, Stephen, you know, think of people, I imagine you're going to have some, you know, Chris and the others in the Division of Exams are going to find some violations that occur because people tried to get cute with that one-on-one versus to multiple recipients, and they had hypothetical performance in it, right? Or they had other stuff like that, you know, that was written into the rule that if it's got hypothetical performance in it, that it, you know, is going to be subject to the rule. So really, really great comments from you both. And across the board, this has been an incredibly helpful conversation, and very, very much appreciate all of your valuable insights on a number of fronts, both from the creation of the rule to, you know, how firms are approaching it now, and the feedback you've seen from the industry, and tips and tricks for many of our folks, recommended courses of action for them to help come into compliance. Again, really useful information for a lot of our listeners. So Stephen, Chris, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
And Carlo, thank you very much for your additional insights and doing such a wonderful job co-hosting with me. Very much appreciated, sir.
Thank you, Patrick. And thanks, Stephen and Chris. You know, this is a 6-episode series, and you guys have done a great job teeing it up. Patrick and I look forward to the other episodes as well.
Awesome. Thank you again. And Stephen, Chris, no good deed goes unpunished here on the podcast. So we'll try. Well, we'd love to have you back here on the show at some point down the road.
Love to be back. Thanks, Patrick.
Absolutely. Sounds good.